www.boomgoddessradio.com. And remember, love and kindness is never wasted. I will see you on the radio next week, and this is Jennifer signing off.
Hey guys, it's me, Isabella Gomez, filling in for Smokey Bear because he's got more to say than just...
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Like, if you're outside enjoying a barbecue, don't let a hamburger distract you from fire safety. Make sure you aren't dumping your hot coals or ashes onto the ground because that could start a wildfire. So take wildfire prevention seriously and let's save the world one day at a time. Juntos con Smokey Bear, podemos hacerlo. Go to SmokeyBear.com to learn more about wildfire prevention.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule, et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulevés, nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent et retombent tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
The Mono Village Jazz Festival, now in its ninth year, happens Friday, August 19th through Sunday, August 21st. Montevilla Jazz supports community building and enriches local culture by showcasing original music made right here in Portland. More festival information can be found at montevillajazz.org.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, remembering one of humanity's worst catastrophes, the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 70 years ago today. Also, the world moves one step closer to a 21st century nuclear conflagration. And we continue our drumbeat coverage of the United Farm Workers' Pilgrimage for Worker and Human Rights. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We report to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are happy to have you along with us today. Well, the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki some 77 years ago marked the crucial turning point in the history of the 20th century. By the end of the war of World War II, Europe, the Soviet Union, and the Japanese Empire lay in ruins, and the United States was in a position of unprecedented power with sole possession of an atomic bomb. Joining us to talk about the bomb then and the bombs today is somebody who has been writing about it for Covert Action. It's got actually a powerful piece by that name, remembering one of humanity's worst catastrophes. His name is John Steinbach, and he is a longtime activist, author, written extensively on environmental, economics, energy, social justice, and nuclear energy issues. John, welcome back to Flashpoints. This is the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. I actually am very familiar with all the implications. I did a documentary called The Road from Hiroshima. People need to understand how long the suffering went on. It wasn't like you bombed and then the next day it was over. You want to talk a little bit about the actual impact? There's an amazing photo up on the internet with your article on covert action. But tell us a little bit about what it was like to be on the ground. Well, I have read Black Rain.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dennis, it's good to be on your show. It's always a pleasure. So on Sunday, I drove from Manassas outside of D.C. up to New York. And our Hiroshima Nagasaki committee organized a farewell supper for the A-bomb survivors. They were in town for the five-year nuclear non-proliferation treaty review conference. It was, because of COVID, it was postponed 2 years. And so four of them made the trip. And of course, I've worked with the Bakasha for 40 years now. And these are my old friends. And maybe the last time I ever get to see some of them. One of the Bakasha that I met, who's the president of the Hiroshima chapter, is the youngest Bakasha active. And his mother was 3 months pregnant with him when the bomb exploded. And when I had a long talk with him about his work, and his major work is trying to convince the second generation Bakasha, the children of the survivors, to continue their parents and their grandparents' work. And it's a challenge, it's an uphill battle. And of course, the Bakasha themselves, the ones that are actually old enough to remember, are in their, at least in their mid-80s, and some of them in their 90s. And it's just more and more difficult for them to travel. So it's going to be up to second generation Bakasha, and then people like you and me who have met the Bakasha and who have heard the stories. But one of the comments that was made, somebody was talking about how horrible the movie The Day After was. And the survivor from Hiroshima looked straight at the person and said, I was there. I was 10 years old. And what happened to me was so much more painful and ugly, and the things that I saw were so horrible, much more horrible than the day after, and anything you can imagine. And I think that's the main point, is that the survivors believe that, you know, if they're not there anymore to tell the world about what the reality is, that the world's going to forget and nuclear weapons will be used again. And the Bakasha believe if nuclear weapons are ever used again, it will be uncontrollable and that it will be the end of the world.
You know, John, I believe I read this in Black Rain, an amazing story of after the bombing, I believe it was the Hiroshima bombing, there was one bridge out of town, the description is coming from a young man who is approaching the bridge, and he sees dozens of people. This is the bridge out of the city, but dozens of people are turning back. They can't, they're afraid to cross the bridge, and he doesn't understand why they're afraid to cross this bridge. And then when he comes up to the bridge and he starts to cross it, he realizes that there's a child sucking at the breast of a corpse. And people are absolutely freaked out and have turned back into the burning city. Stories like that, by the hundreds, by the thousands, people didn't have a clue about what was about to happen, and the fact that an entire city, most of a city, could be leveled by bombs. And then there are the stories of the actual bombing, where the shadows of the dead people, what's left is the shadow on a wall.
So Dennis, there's a film out. It is available. You have to do some searching on the internet, but if you search for the film Prophecy, it's a 42-minute film. It's based on the footage that was filmed by Herbert Cezanne, The U.S. government literally confiscated all of the Technicolor film footage in the world. And that's why, right, if you look at movies from 1946, 47, they're all black and white. The U.S. government wanted to film the devastation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Herbert Suzanne did that. And then, of course, once the federal government saw the footage, they realized they couldn't use it as a propaganda piece, so they classified it top secret, and they buried it in the basement of the National Archives. And then when they finally declassified it in the early 1960s, they classified the declassification. But ultimately, it was discovered, the film was purchased. It was a project called the 10-foot Campaign, and it was the school children throughout Japan that collected the yen and purchased that film footage. So out of that came this very powerful film called Prophecy. So I'd encourage your listeners, go on the internet and Google Prophecy, the movie. It's 42 minutes, and it's if you want to get a flavor, it has several interviews of Ibaka Shah. It has photographs, including a photograph of the one you're talking about, the child suckling at the breast of the mother.
I remember at the massive 1980 anti-nuclear demonstration in New York City, I had the opportunity to be with some Habaksha who were meeting with the downwinders where the bombs were made that were dropped on them. And it was an amazing communication for the downwinders to learn what they would be facing in terms of their own sickness and illness. And it was an unbelievable sharing. And there was also an Australian who was on the ground who filmed extensively, and they shut him down.
Wilfred Burchett, you're talking about
Wilfred Burchett. Right, Burchett.
Yes, because you have to remember there was tremendous disinformation and censorship. I mean, very similar to the type of disinformation that we see right now as we're talking, but it was a lot of it had to do with poo-pooing the idea that radiation was dangerous and that really anyone had suffered from radiation poisoning in Hiroshima. The New York Times sent their mouthpiece there. He reported there's no danger, there's no problem with radiation. But Wilfred Burchett from Australia actually hitchhiked on a U.S. government with the GI and hitchhiked to Nagasaki about a month after the bombing. And he wrote a report, and I want to say it was in the London Guardian, and he titled his report "A Warning to the World" about what he saw. The radiation.
A warning to the world, right?
A warning to the world.
Wilfred Burchett. Yes. How do you spell his name? Is it
B-U-R-C-H-E-T-T, and it's he also wrote at least one, I think, several books. About it, so it's readily available.
It's amazing.
People to get his perspective. He's in the spirit of other whistleblowers, Seymour Persson and other whistleblowers. Julian,
absolutely. And we got to hit this. You know, the big cover story at the time was that there was the United States had to drop these bombs to end the war and save lives. You want to hit that?
Yeah, for sure. That was the big story. Truman said that the bombing saved millions of lives. It prevented an invasion, saved millions of lives. But the reality is substantially different. So, for example, this is not well understood, but Dwight Eisenhower, Douglas MacArthur, William Leahy, Admiral Leahy, he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all of the other, Curtis LeMay, the mad bomber Curtis LeMay, all of the leadership, except for Hap Arnold, all of the military leadership vehemently opposed dropping the bomb. and it was Leahy, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Eisenhower that couched their terms in ethical and moral terms. Eisenhower said we were not taught to wage war against women and children, and Leahy called it, this barbaric weapon. So number one, the military, almost entire military leadership that knew about the bomb opposed the dropping of the bomb. The strategic bombing survey in the fall of 1945, just after the bombing, came out with their formal report, and they said, even had Japan not surrendered, even if the Soviet Union had not entered the war, even if an invasion had not taken place, the atomic bombings were absolutely unnecessary. So, and the Japanese historians that have looked at this, and I would encourage people to look for a book called The Day Man Lost, the Pacific War Research Society, and they're using primary documents that they've unearthed, and they argue that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had absolutely no influence whatsoever on the Japanese decision to surrender. It was entirely 100% because the Soviet Union had entered the war and they realized that they were going to have to surrender either to the Americans or the Soviets, and they chose to surrender to the Americans, but it had nothing whatsoever to do with the dropping of the bombs.
I was gathering an anthology of poets, Poets Against Nuclear Madness, and one of the people who responded was a nuclear physicist / poet editor named Burn Porter. And Burn Porter wrote the most, when I asked for poetry, I got a letter from him, and the letter described what happened after Porter and a whole bunch of the other folks who were working on the bombs saw the headlines in the paper at the University of Berkeley, California, and they all finally realized what they were engaged with and the ultimate implications of their work. And Burn Porter said just about everybody in that dining room left and went crazy. He gave up science and became the editor for Henry Miller, and spent his whole life resisting any kind of weaponry and technology. And a lot of the people who didn't really understand how bad it was going to get, how ugly it would be. And of course, Einstein was essentially kicked out of the room when he tried to argue against taking his invention, his splitting of the atom, and making it into a weapon.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we should talk a little bit about that history, the history of the scientists, how they were responsible for the Manhattan Project, and how so many of them, when they found out that the bomb was going to be used against Japan, how so many of them literally spent the rest of their lives trying to undo the damage that they had caused.
Right.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Say a little bit more about that. I mean, I gave one example. Say a little bit more about
it. Yeah, so it goes back to the 1930s, and it was Lisa Meitner, a famous woman physicist, and Otto Hahn, and they proved that the fission of plutonium would create more neutrons. It produced more neutrons than it would take to set off the chain reaction. And so Leo Szilard and several others, Eugene Wigner and several others, realized immediately the implications of that their bomb could be made. So they wrote a letter, and they organized a delegation to Einstein at his laboratory on Long Island, and they convinced Einstein to write a letter to Roosevelt warning about the possibility that the Nazis might come up with the bomb and encouraging the Manhattan Project. And Roosevelt took that to heart. That was the genesis of the project. Later, Einstein said, had he known that the Nazis were not going to develop a bomb, He would not have lifted a little finger, quote unquote. I wouldn't have lifted my little finger to do this. And he considered it the greatest mistake that he ever made. And Szilard himself went on to found the Federation of American Scientists and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the famous Doomsday Clock. And many of them spent the rest of their lives working for nuclear disarmament, understanding, it's understandable they were concerned about Nazi Germany coming up with the bomb, because Meitner and Hahn were Germans working in France, and Germany had Heisenberg and some of the top physicists in the world. But Nazi Germany didn't develop the bomb. Japan did, and now we know Arjun Makajani in particular has done a tremendous amount of research on this, but we now know that as early as 1943, 2.5 years before the bombs were dropped, that there was a top secret meeting where it was decided that they would not use the bomb against Germany and that Japan would be the target, 1943. So I just wanted to get that out there, because that's an important.
Yeah, that's important. We need to understand the history and the implications. And of course, nuclear weapons have been a threat to society ever since. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about the Hibakusha, and I mentioned the downwinders. And I spent many days, many weeks, investigating the Hanford plant, which is still wreaking havoc and continuing to the death toll in the Tri-Cities where Hanford is, and the Columbia River, as it wraps around Hanford, is still being polluted. I traveled with a scientist, Norm Buskey, who collected berries across the Columbia River, and these berries, he had his Geiger counter with him, and the Geiger counter was going crazy because the berries where the joggers ran across along the river next to the plant were irradiated, were dangerous.
Yeah.
Almost got arrested. He sent a jar to the governor, and they tried to arrest me. He said, you're arresting me. I'm picking these in public area where you're telling people to jog and have picnics. Are you going to arrest me?
Yes, indeed. So for the listeners who aren't familiar with Hanford, so Hanford is one of the oldest of the U.S. nuclear laboratories. It was the reactor at Hanford that actually produced the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. And it produced the plutonium for, I would say, the vast majority of the nuclear weapons, the 30,000 to 40,000 nuclear weapons that the U.S. produced. And, of course, there was tremendous radiation. And what they did is they would take excavating equipment, and they would build these huge trenches, and they would put the high-level nuclear waste in the trenches. And at the same time, the Soviet Union was doing the same thing. So there was a famous accident. The Medvedev brothers, Zorist and Medvedev and his brother, wrote a book that was called Disaster in the Urals. It's the title of the book, if any of your readers would want to inform themselves. But what happened is that in one of these trenches, the plutonium filtered out, and it reached the critical mass, and it actually formed a primitive reactor, and there was massive contamination. Many of the people in Kazakhstan were contaminated. It's a very, very important story that's also well understood. The same thing almost happened in Hanford, and of course, billions and tens of billions and hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent on the so-called cleanup. But the reality is that with the nuclear radiation and the waste, that there is no cleaning it up.
They can't clean it up. They're stuck. It's there.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm remembering as we speak. I'm remembering hospice nurse Betty Perks, who wasn't always a hospice nurse until her kids started dying of cancer, and the people on her block and in her neighborhood started dying of cancer. And I remember sitting with Betty Perks, and her daughter's parakeet was sort of singing and doing its thing. And she was telling me how her daughter had been in the hospital now, it was something like the 11th time in 2 years, and that her son had already died of cancer and that her husband had cancer, and how she used to be very curious and concerned and troubled when her young children used to wave up at the pilots who apparently were measuring the air quality around to keep track, not that they were going to tell the people. And she says, so I always used to wonder why they never, my kids would wave and smile and they'd never wave back. They'd never smile. Now I know why. They were killing us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a similar story. Back in 1988, as a group of Gray Panthers, I was part of the first group to take the riverboat cruise on the Dnieper River from Odessa to Kiev. And so we asked to visit the site of the largest village of evacuees from Chernobyl, from the Chernobyl area. And so we went there, and we were welcomed by the mayor, and he gave a speech, and it was, you know, that's a wonderful speech that, you know, it's very unfortunate what happened in Chernobyl, but it was for the good of humanity, and we're here, and we're all healthy, and we're all feeling good. And so we have these young college interpreters for working for Intourist, which is was a Soviet tourist agency. And they're saying to us in our ear, don't listen to him, he's lying. See the children up there on the balcony behind him? The reason they're not coming down is because they're all sick with radiation sickness.
Mm. Wow. So, we're running out of time. We're running out of time, John, and I do want to make the point that we're at the edge of the atomic clock. There is extreme danger coming from all angles now, and unfortunately, it's sort of like a white male face-off of warriors who somehow can't think of another way to deal with each other. Now, I know the United States is busy blaming China. China's expanding nuclear arsenal, which like is a pittance in the bucket compared to the U.S. And we know Russia's certainly got the same 3,000 that the U.S. has, 3,000 of these nuclear warheads facing each other. How dangerous is that?
No, it's very dangerous. And what makes it even more dangerous, you know, in addition to the U.S.-Russian proxy war in Ukraine, make no mistake, it truly is a proxy war. And the danger there, of course, is that U.S. and NATO are literally face-to-face with Russia. But still, reason why it's more dangerous than ever before is that we no longer have the anti-ballistic missile treaty. We no longer have the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty. So you have these intermediate range missiles in Poland and Romania and other nations, and the Soviet Union has deployed the new version of the SS-20s. They're different now. They're much more sophisticated. The warning time, if either side launches, is going to be less than 5 minutes. Both the U.S. and Russia are on hair-trigger, computer-controlled alert status. Any inkling that there's a nuclear attack is going to result in an instantaneous response. And then you add to that the situation with China. Oh, by the way, before we go, Dennis, have you heard...
Just 1 minute. I'm sorry, we're just at the clock. 30 seconds. Okay, go on.
All right. So you heard how China's retaliating for Pelosi's visit, right? They're sending her back.
Yeah. Listen, we got to leave it there. I'm sorry. I'm smack against the clock, John Steinbach.
No.
Beautiful, powerful article in Covert Action, one of my places to find stories that I'm not going to find anywhere else. It is up now on the web at Covert Action. I believe the title is Remembering One of Humanity's Worst Catastrophes. And that's up there now, right, John?
It is, and thank you so much, Dennis. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Great to have you with us. We'll talk again. There's a lot more to talk about. Stay safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break. We're going to come back with a good brother, Miguel Gavila Molina, who has been marching with the United Farm Workers a lot of miles today, a lot of mileage on the soles, where the soles of the feet meet the creator of our world, the earth. We're coming back. We'll be back soon. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints. Miguel Gavila Molina, you've been doing some walking today?
Absolutely, Dennis. We actually started walking around 7 this morning, you know, to beat the heat before it gets torching, because by 1, 2 o'clock, you can't walk anymore. It's brutal. But we walked from Visalia to Cutler, you know, 12 miles. And, you know, when we started, it was 81 degrees. When we finished, it was 98. So, yeah, and it probably got a little warmer, but you know, it's interesting that as I'm walking, you know, just I mean, beeping cars, trucks, it's just amazing the support by motorists passing by. But at one point, you know, I was starting to sweat. I hardly ever sweat, but I started to sweat because it was, you know, kind of hot. It was a little overcast, you know, so there was you know, muggy, kind of muggy, sticky hot, and I rolled up my sleeves. You know, for the last, probably the last, you know, half leg of the trek today, the 12 miles. And towards the end, the sun was blazing, so I decided, well, my arms are beginning to burn up. So I unrolled my sleeves. And when, you know, I finally ended, I decided, wow, you know, I'm going to roll up my sleeves. I rolled up my sleeves, Dennis, and they were like black and gray. I went, what? Black and gray? But it wasn't on the outside. It was when I unrolled my shirt sleeves and they went over my arms. You know, my arms had been exposed for like, you know, 4 or 5 hours. It was ash, gray, black ash that fell on my arms. I couldn't even see it. But once I put on my shirt, you know, and the sweat, you know, got, you know, onto my shirt, it was ash. And I went, chihuahua. Because, you know, you can see it. But I didn't realize, you know, how intense the ash is, you know, from the fires. But besides that, you know, it was kind of a non-eventful day. But again, you know, it's amazing. Motorists coming in from Concord, coming in from Vallejo, San Jose. Somebody came in from Los Gatos. You know, and different areas. Someone came in from, I believe, Fremont in that area and brought water and fruit. You know, just for the day. Said, we just came for the day just to have that water and to have that fruit. And then they had to go back. This happened like at least half a dozen times. And, you know, I'd go up and ask, where are you guys coming from? Where are you from? And they said it. Oh, we're just here for today. We heard it on the radio.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah, it is nice. It's working. And there's tremendous support, you know. And like I said, motorists. And then, like I said, people coming from the Bay Area, you know, in the greater Bay Area out here to give water and to give fruit and just to be in solidarity. It's so important to the workers, to the, you know, as we call it.
That's our audience. That's our audience. Our audience cares, Miguel.
Yeah,
they care about these issues.
Because I asked a couple, I said, well, where'd you hear this? She goes, we heard it on the radio. I said, Randy, right on. We're doing our job, and that's what's important. And for our listeners, you know, those that support Flashpoints, KPFA, and Free Speech Radio Pacifica, I just want to thank everybody out there, you know, for your support, your solidarity, and keep your thoughts and good prayers coming our way, because we do need them. Tomorrow, we walk 19 miles. The next day, 18 miles. And by Friday, we'll walk another 19. So for the next 3 days, it's going to be 19, 18, 19 miles a day that we're going to be walking in. So, yeah, all the good thoughts that people can send us would really, really matter. It really does matter.
You know, Miguel, I want to hearken back a little bit to those early days for you. I want to remind people that you were a child farm worker, and you worked as a family, and you had a real struggle there, and that the United Farm Workers were like almost a mirage on the horizon. That before the farm workers,
it brought us hope, you know. And I do remember Cesar one time saying, we are human beings. We're not burros, you know. We're not, you know, beast of burden in the fields. That's why all you out there listening, you know, that appreciate the bounty California produces, you know, from agriculture, be it, you know, food, plants, fruit, vegetables, even livestock and fish and everything. You know, most of the time, farm workers, if not the majority of the time, are the ones that plant, sow, cultivate, harvest, process, and eventually serve the food in restaurants. So, I think everyone that appreciates, you know, the great bounty California has to offer, remember that there are people slaving in the fields who need, you know, just human rights and every right that international workers have. And the most important thing, Dennis, this is about, you know, going to the Capitolio to get the governor's signature on, Assembly Bill 2183, giving farm workers the right to vote. You know, everyone has the right to vote. And in these elections coming up, the midterm elections, it's really, you know, there's been a lot. I know, you know, Greg Pallas, yourself, we here at Flashpoints, you know, we're always talking about voter suppression, voter fraud. Well, this is happening to farm workers. That's why this bill is so important, to make sure that farm workers have a voice, have a right to vote.
And this is their right. It's a right for them to vote, to be in the union, right? This is a battle that includes documented and undocumented and getting representation. Yes.
Right, right. And to be able to vote without intimidation. You know, I mean, really, I'm going to vote at the boss's house, at the patron's porch, you know, who can sit out there and intimidate, harass, or even get you fired. You know, people are afraid. Well, people have a right to vote without intimidation, harassment, or retaliation. And this is what this is all about. And, Newsom, you know, if people know Gavin Newsom, give him a call. Tell him farm workers are marching in the heat of the summer through the fields of misery of the San Joaquin Valley just to get you to sign the bill. He vetoed it. He vetoed it once before. Signed the bill so that farm workers have a voice like every other worker in this country has. The right to choose a union and the right to vote.
The right to choose a union and the right to vote. And
to have a voice, yes.
To have a voice. And Miguel, can I just ask you to share a story or two of what the struggle was like being a child and a teenage farm worker? What do you remember about that?
Well, Dennis, you know, as I've shared with you, there was a period in my life when I was a kid that, you know, the patron let us live in a chicken coop that, you know, my father, my mother turned it into, you know, a space to live. But, you know, the slats in the walls, you could see outside, you know, I mean, all around. You imagine a chicken coop, an old school chicken coop. During the rainy season, we had to pick up buckets, pots, pans, whatever, you know, to pick, you know, to collect the waters that's coming through the roof. And we lived like that for a few years. It was just really hard because everybody at grade school, they knew, you know, I was that, I'm not going to say it, but that Mexican, you know, that lived in the chicken coop. And, you know, and then go to school and be taunted with that all day. You know, people used to punch me and kick me, you know, even people I didn't even know, you know, because I was that guy that lived, you know, that kid that lived in the chicken coop. So it was difficult. You know, weekends, you know, everybody's, you know, going to town, going to shop, going to the theaters, going out to, you know, the beaches or whatever. And we were out there in the fields watching people's in their fancy car going out to, you know, have a good weekend. You know, and during summers, you know, during summers, people were planning their vacation. Oh, we're going to go here. We're going to go there. We're going to go spend 2 or 3 weeks there camping. We're going to go to Disneyland. We're going to go to wherever. We didn't have that. You know, summer came. We went out in the fields. And again, you know, you're out there working and you're slaving and you're wondering, wow, you know, my mother used to tell me, you know, mijo, my son, don't worry, you know, these are our ancestral lands. Someday there will be justice. So when Cesar Chavez came out, the Union flag, the red with the black eagle, you know, that represents basically the black is, you know, the red is blood, give me life, and the black is darkness, you know, death, or give me death, you know. So with those kinds of things, you know, I'm going to march till I drop. I'm going to march till I get, you know, justice. And this is what's happening today. You know, here we are, you know, I was 12 years old, as I've said several times, when my godfather and my one of my uncles and two of my father's compadres picked me up at the house, you know, my mother, and she let me go. And I came to the Leno and saw the first pilgrimage in 1966. So, you know, today was kind of like a, you know, quiet day, kind of somber a little bit. And I tell you, Dennis, as I'm walking and I'm, you know, retracing the steps that Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez and hundreds of others did before me, you know, I'm retracing those steps. It really saddened me. I said, look, here I am, you know, 56 years later, having to walk to the Capitolio, 300 plus miles, to a Democrat governor. Democrats are supposed to be labor. They're supposed to support labor. They're supposed to be, you know, the party of the workers. And where is Gavin Newsom? He's a multi-millionaire. He has that Saddleback, you know, winery in the Napa Valley. You know, when I've been out there. We went out there for a protest.
He has a winery? You know. He owns a winery?
Oh, yeah. I think it's called Saddleback. It's in the Napa Valley. And, you know, and I'm looking, and we're looking out there. You know, that's the day we went out there. We actually met at the French Laundry, one of the most expensive restaurants in the country, where he was caught during the pandemic with no mask. I mean, it was a big kind of scandal. But, you know, and you look out in the fields, Dennis, and you see out there, you know, you see people working. It's all brown people, you know. And I say, really, Gavin? These are essential workers. Don't you care about workers, about having... giving them the right to have a voice, you know. But again, yeah. you know, he's been raised to be president. He's been raised to lead. Right. But I'll tell you right now, he is not a friend of the farm workers. And,
no, he is not, Miguel. You know, and we're gonna beat that. We're gonna hit that hard because we're gonna cover this march all the way through. We're out of time now, Miguel. But you know,
we got
the Flashpoints is locking arms with the farm workers as we have for the last 30 years. You stay safe. Really,
absolutely.
Get some shade. Be careful. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, Miguel.
Yes, we will. Please, si se puede.
Si se puede. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Short musical break, and then back with an interview about the march. Stay with us. And and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the pilgrimage for rights from Delano to Sacramento. Sarah Blanco is on that march, and she spoke with a supporter of the pilgrimage, Esmeralda Hurtado, a daughter of local farm workers. She sees her parents' work as labor of love. The interview was done on the second day of the UFW pilgrimage. Listen to this.
Oh, hello. Soy Esmeralda Hurtado, and I'm out here supporting the farm workers because both of my parents are farm workers. They've been farm workers for 20-plus years, actually working. They're working right now, and just wanting to support the movement. I've seen, you know, the intimidation that does happen, the oppression that happens in those spaces, and it's definitely time to change those areas for the farm workers to ensure that they have the equity and the, you know, the privilege that they truly deserve for the work that they're doing for our community. You know, they do a lot in feeding and providing food for everybody's home, and the least they could have is safe and like a safe union as well, and one that's not filled with intimidation and a lot of just yuckiness. So I'm here supporting and doing what I can, again, for my family, but also for everybody else's family out here who is being impacted.
And how long have you had a line of farm workers in your family?
My parents are the first ones. They came to the United States in 92 and started in the farms right away. So they've been out here in these fields since 92. And again, just seeing what they've been through and what they've gone through, it's always just like, and there's been change. I won't say there hasn't been, but there's a lot more that can still be done.
You know, we talk a lot about the plight and the dangers and a lot of really the terrible working conditions. But what I would like to do is also ask you about what are some of the coolest things that your parents talk about doing the work itself?
Yeah, I mean, they've taught me how to grow different crops and stuff, which has been, I think, amazing. They have so much knowledge and what it means to, you know, plant something and nurture it and make it grow. And so thankfully we've also have created our own little garden in our backyard, and that's something I do with my parents even now. We have our lemon tree, our orange tree, our guava, we have pomegranate. So it's like, because of that, we're also able to create our own, like, field in our backyard. And hopefully, it's still growing right now, but hopefully, you know, continue to be able to feed my family in the near future.
What kinds of skills do you see that you have learned from your parents? I mean, of course, you probably learn on your own as well.
Yeah, no, they definitely know how to prep the soil, ensuring that the nutrients are in there, the proper nutrients for the specific plant. And then cutting, you have to do a lot of different cutting and trimming. And so they go out and do that. They have their special gloves and their scissors, and they'll show me, like, okay, this is how you do it. Those techniques that, again, are essential for any type of farming that you're doing, they've acquired those skills and just techniques to know how to do it in the sense that so they don't get hurt for long, since they're doing it for long periods of time.
Tell me about what are some of the blessings that you and or your parents talk about that the farm work has provided for you and your family.
I think definitely for them it's just like that's some stability to be able to get us through and allow us the opportunity for, you know, getting through college and getting access to all of that, because it's something that they didn't get through. So I know they've always tried their best to save any side money to get us any opportunities to get us out to college, and that's been like the biggest, I think, blessing is the access to academia that I would not have had whatsoever had my parents not just continued to do their work.
And that's a big part of the story, is not just the resilience and the strength in the massive amount of skill that people bring with them from ancestors and from their own lands already, and then whatever you learn on the job and from other people. But one thing that I saw as well is the opportunity to give their children and their loved ones a life where they can go to school. So to me, in my mind, I think that requires a lot of saving and a lot of diligence and a lot of determination.
And definitely a lot of sacrifice as well. They had to sacrifice their time to being with us so they could keep working and be able to have that money to put aside to get us on a field trip or to get us a new experience in the world. So definitely, again, super like blessed for my parents to have just not been selfish in that sense, but also like they have done so many sacrifices. Sometimes I'm like, it's my turn to to give back. And so again, that's why I'm here and continuing my career as well to be able to provide for them in the near future.
And what career are you going into?
I'm currently in my master's for social work with health equity and wellness. So again, doing this work and trying to provide resources for people.
That's fantastic. What country did they come from?
They came from Mexico. So they're from Abasolo, Guanajuato, Mexico. Yeah, and they're the only ones in their family really to have been able to make it here. So again, it's like they're creating that legacy for their community and their family as well.
Are you able to tell us about things that you've heard that happen to people when they try to get some basic rights? Are you hearing of physical violence? Are you hearing of more verbal punishment in terms of lack of hours? What is it that you hear either in your research or through people you know?
Yeah, definitely verbal. I've heard a lot of instances of verbally abuse being thrown at certain workers, and most of them being female, a lot of, because they're quote-unquote slower, and so they get yelled at for not keeping up with the group. I've also heard, especially with right now, they're only letting them work 40 hours, even though they're now access to doing overtime and getting paid overtime. And so again, they're using those tactics to not allow them to gain access to, you know, more financial gain. And they're hiring more workers, but only hiring them for those certain hours, so they don't have to give them the opportunity to get more money. And so that's been unfortunate, because my parents were used to a system where they could work a little bit more or, you know, try and find something, but now they're very stuck in just one space. And again, with things going up in price as well, it's like it's not really livable.
It's like a punishment then. It's like, okay, well, now you won't have more than 40 hours. When it gets down to it, if you ask a farm worker if they'd rather just be cut off at 40 hours or work extra hours, even if it's not overtime, we might get different answers than we would expect.
I think, and that's exactly what it is, just, you know, really going to the farm workers and asking what is it that they're wanting and the resources that they're needing. It's the farm workers who are out there, and so that representation and the voting that goes into it needs to come straight from them. And the intimidation that goes into it is just, it's unfortunate, really, because, again, it's following the same, you know, ideas to some extent of what happens on our outside government. And so it's just like, let's make these small union places a safe for everybody, you know, who it's supposed to be representing.
And by intimidation, we're going back to the fact that the farm workers are marching from Delano to Sacramento on a almost month-long trip to ask Governor Newsom to sign a new bill, much like the one he rejected recently, so that farm workers have the ability to vote for their own union representation in a way that doesn't have to be on their boss's property. And so that's what their goal is. It's really about the right to vote, even if it isn't voting for the governor or the mayor per se. It's really about having that option. And so the ones who are intimidating would be obviously the ones who have the most to lose, or anything to lose at all. And that can be some bosses and some growers. I've never met any personally. I can't say they're all like that. And I know a lot of changes are happening. But, you know, there's always that appeal to the growers and to the bosses and the foremans, right? And the people who put together the transportation, there's always that appeal of, please, they're human. Like, what's all that money? What's the more money that you make, we can't take it with us when we go. And at what cost?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, no, and I think that's something we need to consider just in general as humanity as well, of like, you know, we're all human, we're trying to exist here and trying to make our world just a better place. And so how can we support one another and create those environments where we are just, you know, being able to live equitably and being able to live without those extra barriers that exist in our society?
What comes to your mind is some basic civil rights that farm workers are fighting for when we're talking about dignity and respect, but also some basic civil rights or rights that employees should have?
I think, you know, the ability to advocate for themselves, I think a lot of those spaces aren't provided. You know, there's those power dynamics that come into play with the supervisor and the employee. And I think just eliminating that hierarchy and just making it a walking, I always talk about like walking bridge, right? So it's like the supervisor can provide support and skills, and so can the employee, because again, everybody has skills to offer and not just one person is an expert on everything. So I think that's one of it, just creating those spaces of dialogue and communication. And the other thing is really just like safe spaces. I mean, my parents are out working right now. It's going to be 100 degrees or so. I personally don't think it's just for a person to be moving that much and in the heat, plus the body heat that your body creates in general. So it's just like having more regulations on that, because though they say they have, it sometimes doesn't get, it still doesn't get respected.
Do you, and this doesn't have to be about your parents, but just in research or other people you know, do you know if they have to move physically as much in 90 plus weather, 100 degree weather, as they do in 80 degree weather?
I think it really does depend on the space. I know my parents were working in a different space where they did have them just go, go, go. It was like no rest. Right now where they're at with the company, they are very much like take it slow, be okay. They're more in tune with the farmer's body and what's going on, right? So they do provide those spaces of like take a 5-minute break, get your water, go relax. But in the space that they were prior, that was not the reality. It was go, go, go. My mom's legs were hurting and she couldn't stop because, again, she'd get reprimanded by somebody because she was falling behind. And so you do still get those two sides, and even today. It happened this year. So it's like it's still happening.
How was the pandemic affecting the area and the farm work from what you've seen? And the farm workers?
Yeah, no, it definitely impacted them quite a bit. I think a lot of it was also safety. Like, they were scared for their safety, their family's health, but also knowing that they had to come out and make money. And so there was that thing, too, where they were still forced to work through the pandemic because they had to make ends meet, and the financial compensations that the government was giving wasn't enough as well. And so, yeah, putting that all together, it was greatly impacted. My parents personally, they didn't work for a whole year because they did get in a car accident. And so, again, thinking about that, they actually got in a car accident on their first day back on the field. So it's just like, you know, it's wild to think about. They were going through the pandemic as well, experienced the heart of something super traumatic and couldn't get that extra assistance, and had to also leave their community for a year, the people who provide them that emotional support as well. So it was definitely hard on them, and I'm sure everybody else in the community.
How are they doing now?
They're doing a lot better. They're back. They took the year off and are now fully back to work. And they love their job. They're like, this is what we love doing. We've been doing it for a lot of years, and they feel really skilled and super passionate about it. So again, didn't want to take that away from them, but they are a bit older. You know, my dad turned 59 this year, and he's like, Dad, your body, I don't know if it can do all of that, but he's like, it can and it will. So they're out here.
I love that resilience, but I hear you. You're kind of talking to them like, well, maybe some rest time.
Yeah, exactly. Like letting your body just heal, because they also have a lot of different things going on in their bodies because of working in the fields for so long. That's like they definitely need a period of time where they could just relax and let their bodies heal.
And how has it been with protecting farm workers from pesticides? There's this assumption that there's not a whole ton of protections. I know that they probably close fields off and then spray if they need to. There's supposed to be more labels, and schools are supposed to be protected. What are you hearing is happening in terms of pesticide protocol or any poisonings?
I have heard my parents talk about, like, the fields being closed and stuff like that. So that's awesome that their company that they work for is doing that and being fairly consistent. It still doesn't take the fact that they go in there and it gets on their clothes. And so my parents do have their own protocol of when they get home, none of their clothes goes inside because they can smell it on themselves. And you do smell it, and it's sad that it still carries on to them and onto their car and all of that. So although, yes, there's protections, it's still getting on to them. And I don't know what can be done in order to create that safety barrier for them.
Imagine working, 8-hour, 12-hour plus days, and then knowing that you have to take all your clothes off as early as possible to try to prevent it from coming into the home and washing it or what have you. And that's a lot of work. It's also a lot of mental work. It's also frightening, as you said, that you can smell it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's, I guess, the mental aspect of it, too, I think, is something that needs to be highlighted more, of how mentally draining this job truly is. And if things aren't put safely, then that just keeps deteriorating. And the resources aren't there to help also the mental health of farm workers. There's not necessarily a lot of support there. And so, it's a trickling down effect. And I encourage people to really go out there and connect with different groups, different demographics that you're not a part of, and really just challenging the ideas that the messages that they've been given, and, you know, really try to understand a person for who they are and what they bring to the table, and working to eliminate those stigmas, because you do find a lot of beauty when you just learn to take off those glasses, in a sense, you know, that they've put on us to some extent. So I think I always encourage people to go out there and just meet someone new, and I don't know, you might learn a lot and be able to share skills with one another.
Thank you very much. We're here in Rich Grove, California, and the Farm Worker March to Sacramento, pilgrimage essentially to Sacramento, and the workers have taken off. And it was 94 degrees last night at 3 a.m. Thank you so much, Esmeralda, for talking to us about why you're here today, helping out and being here to see the farm workers off on their pilgrimage on day 2. For KPFA, I'm Sarah Blanco.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Special thanks to producer and engineer Rod Akil. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.